session number 15332, reel 2.
Captain Hull, reel 2.
When the fog lifted, it was amazing to see column 11 in front, dead on station. But sadly, when I looked astern, the ships were all over the place. I must say I was very proud to be a British merchant seaman to see such a fine display of seamanship. In spite of the sea fog, everyone on the front line of the convoy was bang on target and on station. The escort had quite a job in rounding up the stragglers, like sheepdogs they were. We then had brilliant sunshine. Ice floes were in the distance, and slush ice on the surface. I remember then an air attack started, and our own RDF seemed to be more powerful and effective than that on some of our escort vessels. We were in a position to communicate to the convoy when the enemy planes were approaching, and I guess some 25 miles away, so at least people could then be prepared and on standby for any air attack. The attack did start in the brilliant light, and a terrific barrage went up from the Allen Bank in the middle of the convoy, from the cruisers, and of course from the escort, and ourselves too. Well, it did seem to me that we were winning, because two planes were shot down, one Russian cargo ship was hit on the foredeck, and I can't remember her name, but smoke was coming from her number one hatch. Anyway, it seemed score one to us, and that was the way we felt. Another air attack started probably 3 hours later, and the same effective anti-aircraft fire seemed to keep the German bombers pretty well long distance. Attacks were made by torpedo craft at the same time, and I think two ships were hit on the extreme starboard side of the column. I remember then going down for a cup of coffee, and then I came up on the bridge once more, and the chief officer looked at me and he said, "I've got some bad news for you. The four cruisers have left." And as I got my binoculars, I could see them steaming off into the starboard side of the convoy, flashing "good luck, bon voyage." And here their escorts went with them. There has been a terrific amount of criticism about that in later years, but it did seem that the German pocket battleship, probably the Scharnhorst and the Nisenau, were expected to come out from northern Norway, and they were going in to try and stop them attacking the convoy itself. But all this has been written very clearly in books and history about those events. We then, 2 or 3 hours later, picked up another formation of, say, 25 Ju-88s and Heinkels from another direction coming in. Brilliant sunshine, and the Commodore ship sent up the message, "Fire off your Hurricane." Well, as we know, or as I realised too, the Hurricanes and the catapult was no match for formations of German bombers. Their full intent was, of course, where a Blohnenvoss plane picking up convoys, one plane, you'd fire off a Hurricane and try and get it shot down before it homed in U-boat packs. But here was one brave Hurricane, like a sparrowhawk, going into these formations of German bombers. I remember the optimism of Alistair Hay, the South African pilot. He was on the bridge at the time with his flying jacket. He and I were good friends, and I often have a laugh today about smoking is dangerous for you. For when the message came, "Fire off your Hurricane," he buttered his cigarette and put it in his flying jacket. The fact being, I would make it clear that there was no hope of ever landing on friendly territory. The only way he would ever survive was to bail out in the icy waters. But that one act of butting his cigarette, putting it in his flying jacket, a thing I'll never forget. I dine out on that when people tell me that smoking is dangerous for me. He took off and we watched him and we were in communication. Our code name was Primrose 1 and his was Primrose 2. We could hear him going in and hear his cannon fire on the speaker in the cockpit of the plane. And he got one and smoke trailing from another. And then we heard his cry, he'd been hit. And the RDF officer who was in communication with him on the bridge, bail out over convoy. And he came roaring in over the convoy and did what we thought in our naivety, some did at least, that he was doing a victory roll. The only way you can bail out of a hurricane, of course, is to turn upside down, push the canopy open and drop. Anyway, he did bail out. There was some fire, again, towards him. In the book or two, it does say, of course, he was fired at and hit. That is not truth. He was hit by a bullet from a Ju-88 rear gunner. He did bail out, and the seamanship of HMS Volunteer, an ancient destroyer, was marvellous. They came alongside of him, and he was picked out. He'd been in the water only 10 minutes. And this time, there's still a raging air battle going on above us. We got the message from the volunteer. Your pilot is safe. He's having a bullet removed from his thigh. And I always remember that message quite clearly. Of course, we sent congratulations to him.
Was he shot at as he bailed out?
Two or three ships, I believe, opened fire, thinking he was an enemy aircraft coming in low over the convoy. But I could not swear to that. There were so many tracer bullets flashing around at that time. Where they came from and to whom, I am not sure. During the second part of that, three planes took a low pass at us, being a CAM ship. I suppose they wanted revenge, seeing our catapult. And they machine gunned us. They shot at our RDF aerial. They hit the RDF aerial. They made the funnel look like a colander. But worst of all, we'd lost communication for listening to more planes coming in. Two brave RDF young seamen climbed up the mast. One was a chap called Eddie Grenfell. He's now a retired lieutenant commander, I believe. They climbed up the mast in this action, and they, believe it or not, they fixed the aerial, and we were in operation once more. Then the same attack, they hit HMS Garland, a Polish destroyer, hit it on the foredeck. This caused terrible loss of life. I think 26 Polish seamen were killed by being hit by bombs. A quick story of that the Garland, within half an hour, was back on radio once more. I visited the Garland in Murmansk. I was taken to the wardroom, which must have been like a surgery with amputations going on. I visited her in Murmansk at anchor, and I saw what I thought was graffiti, on the bulkhead of HMS Garland. And when I asked what it was in the blood of a Polish seaman, and he had written, "I die for Poland." I always remember that so clearly. Well, we proceeded without our hurricane now, and the battle got worse. U-boats were certainly in the vicinity, and in some cases on the starboard wing, you could see the silhouette even of the conning towers against the brilliant ice. The confidence of those U-boats and the limited amount of escort we had certainly must have given the Germans full knowledge that they had us as soon as they could get at us. We, of course, were number 11 ship, that's the extreme left of the front line of the convoy, when three planes dived low at us again, and whilst we did our best and opened fire, almost point blank, I remember two bombs whistling over the wheelhouse, and they hit number 1 and 2 hatch. This hold the vessel on the port side in number 1 hatch, and you could tell by the list that we had that she was making water. Captain Darkin then ordered that it was time that we should have to abandon ship, for no doubt we were going to roll over, who knows, in half an hour or more. So the brave Captain Darkin, with the chief officer, took the confidential books from the chart room, and they went down to the galley to get these books fried in the oven of the galley. Then the lifeboats on the port side, one lifeboat was launched without any problem, and on the starboard side, I was directed by the captain to go and take command of the starboard lifeboat. I got down into the middle of the accommodation and saw that the lifeboat was in the water and a pilot ladder was over the side. I hastened the crew to get down, and I even had my sextant and my chart and dropped this into the boat, where it was splendidly caught by a seaman. Who knows, if we would have been picked up, someone would have to try and navigate. That was my thinking at that time. Then all I do remember is a roar, and somebody shouted, two more planes coming in at low. Well, they were machine gunning. They machine gunned people in the port lifeboat. Again, I'm sure, and I must be kind, they were machine gunning as they came in to bomb. I'm sure even those German pilots, in my view, would not have mercilessly shot at those men in the lifeboat. They were coming in at low level. And I believe, too, two or three of our Dems gunners were at action stations, because I heard our own Oerlikon being fired at that time. So they were responding to our defensive attitude. Two or three bombs hit the vessel at number 4 and number 5 hatch. And I remembered a terrific roar and a splitting in my ears. And before I knew where I was up in the air, and I could see a ventilator and two derricks floating up skywards with me. Then I hit the water. I seemed to go down and down and down. And what was most frightening, hatchboards and debris were shooting up out of the water all around of me. I looked round for my own lifeboat, and it was upside down with some seamen clinging to it. The bitterness of the cold and the shock, I'm not too quite clear. But I did find that I was almost alone in the water and saw in the distance a life raft. I swam towards this, and it was strange to see some of our cargo floating and one bale of cloth. And I got a hold of this, and the bale rolled over, and I could see and read the print, Britain delivers the goods, on the bale of clothing meant for Russian people. I abandoned that pretty quickly and got to this raft. Sitting on the raft was an aircraft mechanic. He was an armourer for our Hurricane, a young man, and he was almost quite hysterical, telling me he was bone dry. What a miracle that must have been for him, because he was blown up and landed on one of our own life rafts and never touched the water. I swam alongside and asked him if he'd give me a pull in. He got hold of me by my jacket, and I got halfway up on the raft when he shouted that my leg was off. My leg was off. And I told him to have another look. I was too frightened to look at my own leg. Anyway, I did brave myself, and I found that what I felt was bone was in fact a small lath of wood with four nails stuck into the starboard bucket, my starboard buttock. It was a blessing when I could pull that out without feeling any pain. And then he dragged me aboard the raft.
What condition were you in by now?
Well, I was certainly feeling so frightfully cold. I could not feel anything, and my legs and my hands were absolutely frozen. And looking around, the attack is still going on. And it was a horrifying feeling that to think you were so alone. Fortunately and mercifully, the sea was calm. But the bitterness, it seemed warmer in the water than when I was on the raft. After that, we looked around and could see the masthead and then the fore turret of a corvette. And bless me, this was HMS Hyderabad.
Were there just the two of you on the raft?
Just the two, yes. The aircraft mechanic and myself. And the HMS Hyderabad, I could hear the engine room telegraph obviously going slow speed. With that, a plane came roaring up on her in her wash and dropped a couple of sticks of bombs. By this time, the Hyderabad had gone full ahead and possibly harder starboard, and the bombs dropped in the wake of HMS Hyderabad. With this, she circled round. And then I could hear the loud hailer. You see what can happen. You see what can happen. Can you hear me? Can you acknowledge? Are you fit enough to jump if we come close into you with our scrambling net? Well, I do remember shouting, so I was told, I'll jump over the bloody moon if you can come in close. The Hyderabad came in close, and I can see that bow wave and the massive bow right towards the raft, and she tipped the raft and we whirled round the port side like a top. With that, sailors in the well of the corvette grabbed us by the hair of the head, and we were over the gunwale and we were flat, stiff as boards on the deck of the Hyderabad. That is what another memory I shall never ever forget. By that, they could not get our clothes off us because we were stiff, stiff as corpses. Anyway, two sailors got a knife and they cut our clothes off. I had to cut them off. And then blankets were put around us and we were carried on top of the engine room grating. And there we were gradually thawed out. But I think the thawing out was equally as painful as the blood started to pump again in one's veins. But that is what I remember.
Had they got any other survivors in the ship?
Yes, the Hyderabad picked up quite a number of our sailors. I'm not too sure how many, because there were two trawlers. Yes, there were two trawlers, one the St. Elston, and I'm in touch too with a great chap who was on the St. Elston, the radio officer. They picked up quite a lot of our survivors. I was told that when the Empire Lawrence blew up, part of our debris landed on the foredeck of one of these rescue trawlers. In fact, I know that is quite true. So she must have been very close to our port side when we were blown up, and magazine in number 5 hatch full of explosives went up like a rocket. Back to the Hyderabad, once that I was thawed out, I was given some clothing and again pullovers knitted by some kind ladies in the UK, and I was asked if I could manage to struggle up to see the commander of the corvette, because he heard that I was the only surviving deck officer from the ship. With this, he did ask me if I felt strong enough and able enough to go and identify some of our dead sailors, because it was essential that they should be buried at sea. So I was taken down to the after deck of the corvette, where I was shown the dead sailors from Empire Lawrence before they were buried with dignity during the Russian convoy towards Murmansk.
I don't think we mentioned the Lady Madeleine as well.
No. I remember clearly now, with my memory, that the Lady Madeleine was the trawler, the rescue vessel, that was close in to our ship when we blew up, and it was the Lady Madeleine who received quite a lot of debris from our Empire Lawrence at the time of the massive explosion. The St. Elston, of course, also was in close escort to us, and she also picked up some survivors as well. The battle continued, and being aboard a corvette, of course, it was a very different environment. They were fine young seamen, but we were all had to huddle down into the what is the wardroom of HMS Hyderabad, and you can imagine that the people who were surviving other casualty ships, we were pretty crowded. We were sleeping on the deck in the wardroom, because there was actually no room for us anywhere else to sleep. She was packed with survivors as well. Lord knows what would have happened if the corvette would have been hit. But we had near misses at that time, and we got safely into the Kola Inlet at long last. And that I do remember, because after we'd been at anchor for some time, a message came through that all survivors will be taken off the Navy ships and would be handed over to authorities on the jetty in Murmansk Harbour. So we were taken by boat and landed at the Murmansk dock. We were on the dock for hours and hours without food, without any nourishment whatsoever, and there seemed to be no control. During this time, of course, ships were discharging, two ships alongside the jetty, and there were air attacks, of course. I remember we were pretty jumpy. Some of us even scrambled underneath the jetty and hid amongst the woodwork of the quay. At long last, somebody came along and said, we will all have to get in these Russian lorries to take us up to Murmansk Hospital. So we went up to Murmansk Hospital, which was a very primitive place indeed. It was terrible to see so many Russian soldiers, blood-stained, lying on straw in the corridors. At least some of we British seamen were given a hospital bed, because the battles were still raging, where the Germans, I believe, were only about 14 or 18 miles from Murmansk itself in that month of May 1942. I also know that they were amputating fingers and toes with frostbite without any anaesthetic. Only anaesthetic was available for major amputations. This is how Spartan it was, but at least it was refreshing to know that we had at least lived through this particular action, and I was grateful to have two arms and two legs at that time, although there were still signs of frostbite in my toes. I know I had a conference with two or three other survivors from other ships, and I was told by a very tired Royal Naval surgeon who had been landed that they were amputating fingers and toes with frostbite. And this poor man, I don't know if he had any sleep for days and days, did tip me off that if I could get out of this hospital, it'd be just as well. because he himself had to return to his ship to sail back to the UK again in another convoy. I suddenly found out that there were survivors at a camp across the Kola Inlet. I said, it's best that we get out of here as quick as we can. There were guards about, and people were very suspicious of strangers. But fortunately, owing to the confusion of air attacks, we managed to get back to the jetty again, where there was a barge and an old ancient little tugboat, and we got on the barge. We managed to communicate that we were going to join the survivors at the other side of the Kola Inlet. And this we managed so to do, where there was a camp there, wooden huts, and there were already, I should think, about 150 survivors had already bedded themselves down there as best they could. When I joined them as an officer, I was requested would I take over X number of seamen in hut number A or B. This I did, and I found that the wooden hut, one bulkhead was stone, and inside was a stone fireplace. So I managed to get some logs, there were plenty around. I got a good fire going, and you stoked the fire from outside of the hut. When we got the fire going, it was most refreshing. We got our heads down for a well-earned sleep. Murmansk was still being attacked, and you could hear the gunfire some 14, 18 miles away over the hills. During the night, I looked at the bulkhead where the fireplace was, and it was black with bugs. The heat had livened the bugs. Apparently it was a punishment camp prior to the war, so I was told.
What did you eat there?
The food was very Spartan indeed. It was a greasy type of pork fat and rice, and it was sour bread. That is all I can remember, a type of soupy tea. They had nothing else, and this is the type of diet, of course, the poor Russians were having as well. So morale was pretty low then, and we were very, very grateful days and days later when the message came that we must be prepared at all cost to evacuate the camp during the early hours of the morning. Again, it was daylight, still daylight, and sure enough, two small pinnaces arrived alongside the jetty, towing lifeboats that they had rounded up from various ships. So it was the quickest evacuation ever you have ever seen. We had little, if any, belongings, so we got in these lifeboats and were towed down the Kola Inlet, where the southbound ship's survivors were at anchor, and we joined. And I joined the Empire Selwyn, and this was in a convoy southbound. The commodore of that ship was a Commodore Gale. So we met again under different circumstances. I understand Commodore Gale, he was drowned at sea during the war, and I think there's some reference to that in one of the books that I do have.
So, Empire Selwyn.